Voice of America in Washington. This is VOA Global. Hi, I'm Jim Stevenson.
Hello to you. I'm Ira Melman. On today's program, we'll tell you about a new program to send Chinese artists and filmmakers to rural areas in that country to learn from communities there.
We know a lot of Chinese smoke, and now that country is mulling a cigarette tax to increase, or rather to curb smoking.
The price of oil continues to fall. Wednesday, it took most global markets along with it.
In the American Cafe, two stories about water and those who swim in it.
Not all of those are human. And David Byrd explores reports that Facebook has plans to expand to the business world.
We'll check sports as well. All coming up on VOA Global from the Voice of America.
This is Daybreak Asia. Glad you could join me for a summary of Asian news and events for Thursday, December 11th. I'm Jim Stevenson. In brief today, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani denounced a U.S. Senate report on CIA interrogation tactics and demanded the United States share information about all Afghan victims of what he called the inhuman torture. Ayaz Gul has more for us from Islamabad.
In a televised speech Wednesday, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani harshly criticized findings of the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee on the CIA torture tactics. He described the abuses as shocking and said there is no justification for such acts and human torturing in the world. The Afghan leader went on to say CIA officials and contractors violated all internationally accepted norms of human rights as well as U.S. laws. Ghani says, unfortunately, the report shows Afghan citizens were also tortured and their rights violated, but their number is not known. The state of Afghanistan condemns it in the strongest possible words, he adds. The president goes on to say his government wants to know the names and precisely how many Afghans had been victims, so we get to know them and take steps to restore their rights and honor. It is particularly very sad and upsetting to know that some of these detainees were completely innocent and it was established they were innocent. But even then, they had to suffer abuses at the U.S. detention centers, Ghani says. The U.S. Senate report has disclosed CIA interrogators at secret detention centers, including one said to be near Kabul, used tactics such as beatings, sleep deprivation, chaining to walls, and exposure to cold while questioning terror suspects. President Ghani assured his nation that under recently signed security agreements with the United States and NATO, foreign forces no longer will have the right to hold detainees in Afghanistan after December 31st, when international forces will end their combat mission and most withdraw from the country. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
In China, a former top economic planning official has been convicted of bribery and sentenced to life in prison. He becomes the latest high-profile figure to be brought down by China's anti-corruption campaign. The official Xinhua news agency said Liu Tianan was found guilty of taking $5.8 million in bribes during his time as the deputy head of the National Development and Reform Commission, China's top economic planning body. Liu at first forcefully denied the charges, but at his trial in September, the 60-year-old was seen tearfully confessing to taking various bribes, including cash, a Porsche, and a luxury Beijing villa. That Liu would be found guilty was never in doubt since China's Communist Party-controlled courts have a conviction rate nearing 100%. But prosecutors had pleaded for leniency, arguing he had cooperated with investigators. In the end, the sentence delivered Wednesday was the maximum allowed for the crimes. Liu, who also served as the director of the National Energy Administration, is one of more than 50 high-ranking officials to face charges under President Xi Jinping's anti-graft campaign. Many more low-level officials have also been brought down. Student leaders in Hong Kong are vowing to stay until the end as authorities prepare to clear the last remaining protest sites. Student leaders late Wednesday called on everyone who has participated in protests over the past 2 months to return to the streets before police move in early Thursday. Alex Chow, the Secretary General of the Hong Kong Federation of Students, says authorities have left protesters with little choice but confrontation. The government is appealing for protesters to leave the occupied areas before police arrive. Police have given the protesters until Thursday to remove the street barricades at the territory's remaining protest sites in the Admiralty and Causeway Bay neighborhoods. The protesters are calling for fully democratic elections for the city's top leader in 2017. Authorities refuse, insisting all candidates for chief executive be approved by a committee made up of mainly people loyal to Beijing. Russian President Vladimir Putin is visiting India today for a one-day annual summit that will seek to reinvigorate the once close relationship that has lost some of its spark in recent years. Anjana Pasricha joins us from New Delhi, where she says the visit will focus on deepening energy and trade ties.
Out of the dozen or so agreements that New Delhi and Russia are expected to sign Thursday, the most significant could be potential deals for joint exploration of oil and natural gas in Siberia. In an interview to an Indian daily, the Russian president said, "We expect to secure ourselves the role of a reliable energy supplier to Asian markets." On its part, energy-starved India wants to diversify its oil suppliers, which mostly come from the Middle East. Bharat Karnad is a strategic analyst with New Delhi's Center for Policy Research.
They need commitments, especially on the oil investments and in increasing Indian oil investments, which for Russia, you know, the energy sector is the economic driver there. So these are the sorts of things that the Russians are looking for, to regain their lost confidence in New Delhi.
Faced with Western-led sanctions, Russia is turning to Asia for more trade and investment. And as they prepare for the summit, the allies from the Cold War days are both stressing their commitment to do more business and transform the relationship that has sagged in recent years. President Putin called India a reliable and time-tested partner. Indian officials underlined New Delhi's commitment to its long-standing partner. Joint Secretary in India's Foreign Ministry, Ajay Bisaria, says bilateral trade at $10 billion is far below potential and efforts will be made to increase it.
India has said clearly that it cannot be party to any economic sanctions against Russia. President Putin's visit is a landmark event and is expected to provide a fresh impetus to the existing excellent bilateral relations between our countries.
New nuclear plants to be built by Russia, an oil and gas pipeline between the two countries, the sale of Russian rough diamonds directly to India for cutting and polishing, and building advanced weapons will be on the agenda. Observers say Russia is irked that India is increasingly turning to Western suppliers, including the United States, for its military equipment. Commentators have noted that President Putin's visit comes ahead of another high-profile visit, that of U.S. President Barack Obama, who comes to India in January as the chief guest for the country's Republic Day celebrations. That visit is seen as a signal of efforts being made by Prime Minister Narendra Modi to raise ties with Washington. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Daybreak Asia comes to you every weekday on VOA Global. It's also a podcast. Subscribe to it for free at voanews.com.
You are listening to VOA Global, and we're going to give you a chance to tell us what you think of what we are doing. No, don't go that far. how what you think about some stories that we have been doing, and also a little offer for you. Here's a story we did, doing. Pakistani education activist Malala Yousafzai and Indian child rights advocate Kailash Satyarthi made history Wednesday as they accepted this year's Nobel Peace Prize at a ceremony in Oslo, Norway. Mr. Chaudhry from Rawalpindi in Pakistan says, "I extend heartiest congratulations to both Nobel Peace Prize winners, one from Pakistan, the other from India. Both daughter and father are the torchbearers of peace. We all should, at individual and collective levels, give a chance to peace to prevail across the globe."
Well, North Korea and China have criticized the United States over a CIA torture report. The United States frequently voices concerns about human rights abuses in China and North Korea. Those nations are now taking Washington to task after a U.S. Senate report said the CIA tortured suspected terrorists. We heard from Mean Bill, I guess that's an appropriate name for the story, from the United States. It seems that the Beijing News knows all about how American politics works in the United States, and they recognize that the part that Bush could be held responsible for, that was the second President Bush, was released by the Democrat-led Congressional Committee, and the rest was withheld for political purposes, and the U.S. Probably still does those horrible things like torture that they've accused the North Koreans and China of doing.
Well, that's Mean Bill. Here's a Hung Man. People visit Vietnam to witness the modern-day hells, he said, built by the U.S. and its puppet regime during the Vietnam War. You can touch various kinds of tools made in the USA for torturing dead political prisoners. And that is a look at your reactions.
You know, you can write to us at VOA Asia at voanews.com if you'd like to comment on any of the stories you see on our website. And also, if you'd like to request one of our 2015 VOA calendars, they're absolutely free.
Can I get one?
Well, you can just get one out of the box. Yeah, you don't have to write to us. Right. You're already here.
But I feel like I'm stealing it.
No,
I
need it sent to me in the mail. You can have one. Right, VOA Asia at voanews.com. Write to us and include your full postal address.
The mix of an Irish anthropologist with an interest in pottery, a small southern village in Japan, and plenty of sake or rice wine to drink would inevitably produce a great story. Well, it is indeed told in the book Folk Art Potters in Japan. Hi, I'm Jim Stevenson with Authors on Asia. We open the book today with Brian Moran, a professor of social anthropology at Copenhagen Business School and part-time at the University of Hong Kong. His account of potters in Japan with a focus on the Japanese Minge movement or the field of folk art is especially interesting in terms of the style of pottery itself, the hidden social structure of the village that defined the ways of the craft, and the surprise British influence nearly a century ago.
Folk art pottery in Japan, it's decently written and it doesn't have jargon, so I praise it on that count, but it's an academic book.
This was the village of Sariyama, correct?
That's right. Sariyama is a very common name, actually, in the south of Japan. It just means plate mountain. It refers to where clay is dug. And so there's four or five places in Kyushu, in the south of Japan, where there is clay available, where people learned how to make pots. And so they're actually called Sariyamas. But the one I was at was called Sariyama, and then they, in order to distinguish it from the other Sariyamas, they gave it a second name, which was Onta. And I was looking at the Japanese folk art movement, which was led by a gentleman called Yanagi Soyotsu, together with several people who became very famous potters in Japan, Kawai Kanjiro and Hamada Shoji. And together, back in the 1920s, they came up with this notion of folk art, which they called Minge, and had ideas about how it should be made and what were the good things about it and things like that. And one other person who was involved, very importantly, was the British potter Bernard Leach, whom I met back in 1976, 5, I think. He sort of was the courier, I guess, of a cultural intermediary between Europe, the West, and the Orient, the East. And he took several of Yanagi's ideas and took them back to Europe and made Folkcraft famous in both Europe and America, of course. So, in fact, what I discovered for the pottery, that it was very similar to what other anthropologists had found out about rice agricultural villages. The difference was that instead of growing rice, they were making pots, they were preparing clay. After I finished and went back to England to write up my dissertation, I realized that the folk art ideals that Yanagi was talking about had actually come from England, from William Morris and the arts and crafts movement back in the 19th century in Britain. And there were incredible parallels between the work of Thomas Carlyle, John Ruskin and William Morris on the one side and Yanagi on the other.
That must have been a wonderful surprise for you to unearth.
Yeah, it was wonderful. What was not so wonderful was the fact that in order to get my information, for the most part, I had spent an awful lot of time drinking sake, Japanese rice wine, with the potters. And potters tend to drink a lot. And the reason I had to drink was that when we were drinking, the potters would tell me all the things that they never told me during the daytime. So I had two kinds of information. One was the public story that went on during the daytime, where they would answer my questions. And then at night time, when we started drinking and we were getting pretty drunk, then they would start to tell me all the things that were really going on. And that was quite amusing, but not very good for my liver.
Social anthropology professor Brian Moran, author of Folk Art Potters in Japan, Beyond an Anthropology of Aesthetics, published by Routledge. I'm Jim Stevenson. We'll pull another volume from our bookshelves next Thursday when you may hear more authors on Asia on VOA Global, or anytime by visiting the VOANews.com website.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. China's State General Administration of Press, Publication, Radio, Film, and Television recently announced a new program to send artists and filmmakers to rural areas to learn from communities there. The country's media regulator says it wants the participants to form a correct view on art. Critics say the new program is reminiscent of the country's Cultural Revolution from 1966 to 1976, when artists and intellectuals were sent to the countryside to perform manual labor. Jeremy Goldcorn is the director of Danway, a Chinese media research firm based in Beijing.
Still not very clear what it'll actually mean, whether it'll mean people are sent to go and live in the countryside or sent to make documentaries about the countryside or... And it's compared in the Western media to the Cultural Revolution, which I think gives people the wrong idea, because this is, you know, this is not the time of the Cultural Revolution. Society is very different.
Chinese-born writer An Shimin spent part of her youth in a labor camp during the Cultural Revolution. She now lives in California. She welcomes the new program because she believes Chinese literature has become too commercial.
My first reaction was... It's about time, because right now, because the profit-driven market has been China's main thing for over 25 years, and everything is for money, and that's pretty much is out of control right now. And it's kind of start to hurt the children, the next generation. I go back to China every year and ship boxes of books. It used to be quality literature. But nowadays, there's no decent books, really. I find myself, my boxes is getting smaller and smaller and smaller because there's nothing to buy.
The new program follows an October speech by President Xi Jinping, who implored artists and writers to promote socialist values and reject what he called the stench of money. The media in China compared the speech to one in 1942 by Mao Zedong, who said the arts should contribute to the communist effort. According to Judith Shapiro of American University, who has written about China's cultural reforms, the arts are considered a vital part of communist society.
The notion under socialism has always been that artists and writers are engineers of human souls, and the duty of artists and writers under socialism is to help the state to mold a kind of citizen that has a healthy outlook.
Shapiro said recent market pressures have not always yielded the best artistic efforts in China.
To an extent, in literature and the arts, there has been a kind of a turn to sex and violence as a way of simply selling copies or getting more viewers. So I think that that's where the party is coming from. But, you know, that said, people stopped believing in this stuff a long time ago.
Goldkorn believes the new program to send artists to the country for at least 30 days sends a chilling message to those who want to express their views.
It's difficult to see how it will have a beneficial effect on the arts when the room for free expression is so constrained. Does that mean if you send people who have for the last 2 years been making TV dramas about urban people with family and real estate problems, you're going to send them to the countryside for a month and then they're going to come back and suddenly make deep works of, you know, significance that are not commercial?
Min is also concerned that the program to send artists to rural areas might overstep the boundaries of free expression.
Yes, it's a big thing. It's a big thing on my mind, even though I support Xi Jinping's point of view, and he has the guts to come down and to do this. It's a very sensitive issue for us, because the memory of the Cultural Revolution, of Mao's purge, is very still fresh. And we haven't really officially started to actually deal with what happened during the Cultural Revolution and the spiritual pollution.
Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
From Washington, this is the Voice of America. Along with Jim Stevenson, I'm Ira Melman. Here's a look at Asia business. Asian stock markets were mostly lower Wednesday as data from both China and Japan pointed to continued weakness in the world's second and third largest economies. Japan's benchmark Nikkei 225 slipped 1.6% after a government survey showed a deterioration in business sentiment in the current quarter, especially among smaller companies. Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index slipped 0.1%, while the Shanghai Composite rose 0.3% after a dramatic tumble Tuesday. In South Korea, the Kospi lost 1.3%, and Australia's S&P ASX 200 fell 0.4%. Shares in Southeast Asia were mixed.
China reported Wednesday its consumer price index rose 1.4% in November. That's the slowest pace in 5 years and a sign of weak domestic demand. That was way below the government's target of 3.5%, although lower oil prices are seen as an important factor.
China's government is likely to raise cigarette taxes in order to boost prices and deter smoking, according to an official, amid a push by the nation of 300 million smokers to crack down on the habit. The National Health and Family Planning Commission is joining with other government agencies to lobby for an increase in tobacco taxes. That, according to the commission spokesman, as saying that, and quoted by the official Xinhua news agency, reforms to China's tax and fiscal controls provide, they said, a rare chance to take advantage to raise tobacco taxes and prices for tobacco control.
Mazda is expanding its U.S. recall for Takata airbags. It may explode, and rather the entire country is now under those recalls following the Japanese rival Honda in its decision. That's business news on VOA Global.
This is Today in History. On this day in 630, Muhammad, the founder of the Muslim religion, led his army into Mecca. On December 11, 1792, charges against French King Louis XVI were presented at his trial. His conviction and subsequent execution ended the absolute monarchy in France. In 1917, General Edmund Allenby entered Jerusalem on foot and declared martial law after the successful British conquest of Palestine. On this day in 1918, Russian writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn was born. Through his books, the world came to know the horrors of Soviet leader Joseph Stalin's prison system. In 1936, after ruling less than 1 year, King Edward VIII became the first English monarch to voluntarily abdicate the throne. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
There's a story. Well, we normally think of athletes as being tough, but maybe the toughest are ice hockey players. If you want proof, just check this out. New York Rangers defenseman Kevin Klein Monday night lost part of his ear after he took a high stick from a member of the Pittsburgh Penguins. Klein had the chunk of the ear stitched back out on the ice in the second period, and scored the winning goal as New York beat Pittsburgh 4-3.
I hear that. Wow. Call him Klein Van Gogh, huh? As a bonus, it looks like his ear is going to be okay.
Yeah. I mean, if you were to think of who the toughest athletes might be,
you would
think is hockey players.
Yeah, well, some, you know, others around the world might say rugby. They might say, cricket even.
Australian rules football.
Yeah.
Yeah, but as far as just tough people, mostly Canadians.
Steve Norman with the latest world news next. He's tough.
Oh, yeah.
And now, VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Palestinian official killed in a clash with Israeli soldiers, an Ebola update plus new revelations regarding the U.S. CIA torture report. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. A Palestinian cabinet member died shortly after a West Bank protest on Wednesday in which witnesses said Israeli troops fired tear gas at him and dozens of Palestinian marchers. Wavi Turk said he and others were there only to plant olive trees and that the cabinet member Ziad Abu Ayn was being beaten by the Israeli soldier. Several dozen Palestinians were headed to agricultural land near the West Bank village, close to an Israeli settlement and mostly off limits to the village's farmers. Mustafa Barghouti is a Palestinian Legislative Council member.
What we see today is unprecedented escalation of violence from the Israeli side, as if the Israeli government is trying to use Palestinian blood for their election purposes. What is happening is unacceptable, but it will not stop the popular nonviolent resistance in Palestine, and it is a proof that Israel understands only the language of force, and it should be taken immediately to the International Criminal Court for the war crimes they are committing against the Palestinian people.
What killed that minister remains unclear, and his body will undergo an autopsy attended by Palestinian, Jordanian, and Israeli pathologists, that according to the Israeli army. Abu Ayn headed a Palestinian Authority department dealing with Israeli settlements. World Health Organization says another 318 people have died of Ebola in West Africa, bringing the death toll from the epidemic to nearly 6,400. In the latest update on Wednesday, the WHO said the bulk of new Ebola-related deaths and cases are in Sierra Leone, where it says transmission of the Ebola virus remains intense, especially in the capital, Freetown. The WHO says Sierra Leone now has the highest number of reported cases, standing at 7,987. Total cases in all in West Africa, just under 18,000. New study finds rampant violence throughout the world takes a particularly heavy toll on women and children. World Health Organization, which has just published its first status report on the prevention of violence, is calling for greater efforts globally to prevent violence. Lisa Schlein reporting from the launch of that report in Geneva.
A survey of 133 countries shows one in four children has been physically abused. One in five girls has been sexually abused. One in three women has been a victim of physical and/or sexual violence by an intimate partner, and one in 17 older people reports having been abused in the past month. The report says about 80% of the 133 countries surveyed have enacted laws against rape, domestic violence, carrying weapons in schools, and against abuse in institutions for older people. But just more than half of the countries report these laws are being fully enforced. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Turkey's Education Council has been criticized for proposing compulsory religious classes for young children and values education at nursery schools, along with classes teaching Turkey's ancient Ottoman language. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Education in Turkey has become one of the front lines in a battle between secularists and the religious to win over future generations. The main opposition, Republican People's Party, is accusing the council of dragging the country into the past with its proposal that schools teach the now-defunct Ottoman language. The National Education Council, which advises Turkey's Ministry of Education, called for compulsory religious classes in high schools to be doubled to 2 hours a week and extended to all ages. Critics accuse the Islamist-rooted ruling AK Party and the president of wanting to end the Turkish secular state. Dorian Jones, Istanbul.
Former Polish President Aleksander Kwasniewski says Poland let the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency run a secret prison on its territory, but he says Polish officials did not authorize harsh treatment or torture of suspected terrorists at that site. In an interview on Wednesday with a Warsaw radio station, Mr. Kwasniewski said he urged that U.S. President George W. Bush, at the end all U.S. intelligence efforts at the prison, and he said that was more than 10 years ago. Mr. Kwasniewski said the efforts were halted at some point. This is the first time the former Polish president has publicly acknowledged the existence of the prison after denying it for years. It is believed the CIA ran the facility in Poland in 2002 and 2003. Mr. Kwasniewski made his remarks a day after a U.S. Senate report revealed the CIA had used extreme methods amounting to torture to interrogate prisoners after the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on the United States. And in light of the release of that report detailing the CIA's torture in secret prisons, we look into how the psychological and physical trauma of torture can be healed and how that journey is complicated for refugees. VOA's Adam Phillips reports on a University of Vermont clinic that takes a holistic, culturally sensitive approach to helping torture victims to cope and move on.
The northeastern state of Vermont is small, quaint, and undeniably Yankee, but it's also home to some 6,000 refugees from over 25 countries, half of whom have experienced torture, such as electrocution, controlled starvation, rape, and the agony of watching a loved one get hurt or killed.
That would be more psychological torture.
That's psychologist Karen Fondacaro, director of the Survivors of Torture and Trauma Clinic in Burlington, Vermont. She adds that traumatized refugees from such distant locales as Somalia, Sudan, Rwanda, and Iraq must also try to get their bearings in a strange new land.
And you're often suffering with poverty, discrimination, language barriers, and difficulty with housing and employment.
That's why Fondacaro's clinic also offers social work and legal services, in addition to personal and group mental health therapy, where clients are encouraged to tell their story to a psychologist or a group of other survivors. Healing through storytelling is a technique shared by Western psychology and many traditional cultures.
You get the story out and it's sort of on the table and it's not just stuck in you kind of thing. You're observing your own story. It goes from a hot memory to a cooler memory.
Psychologist Karen Fondacaro is director of the Torture and Trauma Survivors Clinic at the University of Vermont. Adam Phillips, VOA News.
Pakistani education activist Malala Yousafzai and Indian child's rights advocate Kailash Satyarthi made history on Wednesday as they accepted this year's Nobel Peace Prize era ceremony. It happened in Oslo, Norway. 17-year-old Malala is the youngest Nobel laureate, with Satyarthi the first Indian-born Peace Prize winner. Speaking at the award ceremony, Malala said that it's time to take action to help children, not to pity them. Two are sharing an award of about $1.1 million. And those are some of the stories making news. Find out more right here at voanews.com.
is Business News on VOA Global. Jim Stevenson along with Ira Melman. U.S. stocks dropped more than 1% Wednesday as the energy sector resumed its recent slide along with crude oil prices and added to global growth worries. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 268 points or 1.51% to close at 17,533. The S&P 500 lost over 33 points, that's 1.63%, closing at 2026. And the NASDAQ composite dropped 82 points, or 1.73%, to finish at 4684. It was the largest daily percentage drop on the S&P 500 since October 13th.
A lot of this apparently has to do with the price of oil. It took another dive Wednesday, plunging to five-year lows amid mounting evidence that global supplies are far outstripping demand. The U.S. Energy Department reported a surprise increase in domestic oil inventories, and OPEC projected that next year demand for its crude would sink to levels not seen in more than a decade. Benchmark U.S. crude slumped 5% to $3.07 to $60.75 a barrel Wednesday. Prices haven't been that low since July of 2009.
Morgan Stanley has agreed to pay $4 million to settle federal charges of failing to prevent the unauthorized purchase of $525 million in Apple stock by one of its customers. The Securities and Exchange Commission announced the settlement Wednesday with the big Wall Street bank. The SEC said Morgan Stanley violated a rule requiring brokerage firms to have strong risk measures in place before they give customers access to the markets.
And that is a look at international business news coming your way every day on VOA Global from the Voice of America.
This is VOA Global on the Voice of America. Jim Stevenson with Ira Melman. Coming up, we've got David Byrd's Now segment. And David is going to ask you if you're on Facebook. We'll find out why in just a minute. But first, the American Cafe.
American Cafe. Both stories deal with water. I'm trying to find connective issues here, you understand. Although these are, one is, deals with whales. I think you'll enjoy that. And also, more and more people swimming, but not with pools. I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. In the heyday of commercial whaling during the 19th and 20th centuries, the giant marine mammals were killed by the tens of thousands. By the time an international moratorium was put in place in 1986, some populations had declined by an estimated 66 to 90%. Since then, whale populations have rebounded, and they're improving the ocean environment. More from VOA's Roseanne Skirble.
More people are seeing more whales today than ever before, says whale watching guide Maureen Gilbert.
2 years ago, we had this huge influx of great of the blue whales that came. Last year, we also got good blue whales. This year looks like it's going to be a stellar year again for blue whales.
Blue whales are among the so-called great whales, the largest animals in the history of life on Earth, that also include gray, bowhead, and sperm whales. For many years, they were considered of little consequence to ocean life, says Joe Roman. The University of Vermont conservation biologist is lead author of a new study that found that just the opposite, that great whales have a powerful and positive impact on how the ocean works. He spoke via Skype.
So whales dive deep to feed. They come to the surface, and as it turns out, they defecate or they release whale poop at the surface. And those that has lots of nitrogen and other nutrients, so it can increase productivity in the areas where whales are feeding.
And when whales die, they sink to the floor and provide new habitat. But even as whales rebound, they are not immune to human threats in the ocean. They're run over by container ships, caught in fishing nets, and disturbed by noise from ocean traffic or sonar signals, says Margaret Williams. She directs the World Wildlife Fund's Arctic program and spoke via Skype.
So shipping is increasing in the Arctic. Plans for offshore oil and gas development are increasing. And so World Wildlife Fund is working with government, communities, industry, and other conservation groups to identify those areas that are very, very important for whale species.
Williams says whales deserve this protection. They are, as the study underscores, more valuable than anyone ever imagined to us, to fisheries, and to the ocean itself. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Growing numbers of swimmers are trading the comfort of the pool for a workout in open water. They are known as wild swimmers. It seems an appropriate description when you consider they dive into lakes, rivers, and oceans almost any time of the year. Correspondent Tom Bonsi reports from the northwestern port city of Seattle on how the rising popularity of open water swimming is reflected in races at an unusual new business.
Sure, you'll see people taking a quick dip at Seattle's Alki Beach at the height of summer, but this is October. The salt water of Puget Sound is 13 degrees Celsius, and the air not much warmer. Hence the involuntary sound effects at the beginning of a group swim. The first one into the water is a 43-year-old tech worker from suburban Seattle, Mike Tanner.
You know, I usually swim from about May until end of November in open water, and then I go back to the pool again and wait for May again.
And so most people would probably go to Mexico or Hawaii at this time of year, right?
I'm not very bright, and it's a bit of a challenge, and I get bored in a pool.
This day, Tanner is a paying customer on an escorted swim excursion. More than a dozen swimmers, almost all in wetsuits, trail behind an orange kayak for a 1.5-kilometer saltwater swim. Trip leader Gila Muir paddles the first of the support boats.
A swim excursion is not a race. That's the primary differentiation. It's an expedition. It's an adventure.
Muir has turned the concept into a business called Say Yes to Life Swims. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Seattle.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. You are welcome in every day at voanews.com and many podcast platforms.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. Are you on Facebook? Have you ever thought of using Facebook for your business? Well, now it appears that Facebook has been thinking the same thing. Multiple reports say the social media firm plans to launch a new network for the workplace, Facebook at Work. The site will reportedly look and operate like the personal website does, but it will allow users to chat with colleagues, share data and information, graphics, and to collaborate on documents in a space that's separate from their personal Facebook pages. Kip Marlowe is the founder of Marlowe Surgical Technologies and the author of The Entrepreneur's Success and Sacrifice. He told me that Facebook at Work could be great for small businesses.
Well, I think they have taken some hits as far as Facebook use in the business office, because there's a lot of, especially from a small business owner standpoint, there's a lot of the small business people that know that much time is wasted in the office by administrative staff, especially looking at the Facebook page and, you know, sharing pictures of the meal they had last night. And I think Facebook is realizing that, that there is a need and there is a potential profit in having basically a private Facebook account for a company. And I think it could be really, really big.
Marlowe said the applications for business-to-business sharing and collaboration are huge, but Facebook will have to make sure that secret information stays secret.
The idea of sharing, for example, you have a company, and you have a project within the company, and you've got 100 employees, just 100, and you're developing a new product, and that product might be a patentable product. And you have a project group that's in charge of that. As long as they can send each other information on it, just like they were in a meeting, upload photos, upload graphs, talk about what they think is this is patentable or that is patentable, this could be huge because as long as they keep it private, and that's one of the problems Facebook could face.
Facebook came under criticism for manipulating users' news feeds in order to check their emotions as part of a study. Kip Marlowe says that kind of interference will not be tolerated with the B2B application.
They cannot take any of that privacy data. It just cannot be done. If it's done one time, the project's over. Because it could, if you picture this group that is making this product or designing this product and communicating with each other, and maybe it's a patentable product. If that information ever got beyond the company walls or beyond the Facebook at Work page, it could devastate an organization. And you would lose trust forever.
One group that will need convincing is chief information officers, company officials who don't want their employees wasting time looking at Facebook when they should be working. Some companies have even banned employees from logging onto Facebook. Kip Marlowe says overcoming the fears of time wasting is another hurdle that Facebook at Work will have to get over.
I think another roadblock, especially with small business owners, is that they have a hard time with their staffs now using Facebook. Facebook is like the old cigarette break, David, you know, where you go outside and you have a smoke. Well, now they get on Facebook, and there's a lot of time wasted, and there could be a credibility problem between Facebook and people who run companies. And those are the things that Facebook has to overcome.
Facebook is also taking on some tough competitors, including Microsoft, LinkedIn, Google, and others. But Kip Marlowe says people are used to using Facebook in their personal lives, so the shift to a business application should be easy. A definite launch for Facebook at Work hasn't been made public, but you can be sure the Menlo Park, California company isn't going to delay for too long. So what do you think? Would you use Facebook at Work? Let us know by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And you can always email your questions or comments to voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
This is VOA Global on the Voice of America. Jim Stevenson with Ira Melman. Coming up, we'll have our music feature of the day. You know, it's almost holiday time, so we're going to find out what is popular this time of year. And first, we've got sports coming up. You know, Ira, I heard a story that they're going to bring some snow to Beijing.
Yeah, that they're going to do, and we're going to cover that story for you if there's snow not already there. We haven't checked the weather forecast. We're not sure, but they're going to need to make some if they don't already have it. From the Voice of America, we check sports. Lionel Messi in Barcelona beat Cristiano Ronaldo and Real Madrid to top the Associated Press Global Football 10. Both Messi and Ronaldo scored hat tricks at the weekend, and despite Ronaldo setting a Spanish league record with his 23rd treble, Messi takes the leading player honors after propelling Barcelona to a 5-1 victory against Espanyol.
Champion Japanese rider Yuichi Fukunaga stormed a victory at Hong Kong's Happy Valley in the International Jockeys Championship. That happened Wednesday. Fukunaga claimed two of the four legs to become the first Japanese jockey to win the prestigious series outright. He finished last in his only previous IJC in 2011, but obviously had learned some lessons from that experience. The first leg went to New Zealand's James McDonald on the Peter Holyoung-trained Spectator. Fukunaga finished in the middle of the field on the Tony Millard-trained Medic Swordston then.
Well, easy for you to say.
Yeah.
China's National Stadium, better known as the Bird's Nest, will host the 2014-2015 Aerial FIS World Cup from the 20th and 21st of December, the first stop for the five-event freestyle skiing series. More than 50 of the world's top freestyle skiers from 9 countries, including Australia, Canada, UK, and the U.S., will compete for titles in individual and team contests. This event is important for the Beijing organizers, as it will be seen as a test ahead of the International Olympic Committee's vote on the host city for the 2022 Winter Olympics on July 31st next year. Beijing and Almaty in Kazakhstan are the only two cities competing for the right to host the 2022 Games.
Well, although the boys of summer aren't on the field, John Lester is a little bit richer. He agreed to a $155 million 6-year contract with the Chicago Cubs in Major League Baseball deals. First big deal of the offseason involving a top-level starting pitcher.
And John Daly, Here's the golf story of the day. He hasn't had a week like this in some time. Not only did he win, he got engaged. He announced on Twitter last night that he popped the question to Anna Kladikas, who he's been with for the last 6 years. She said yes, and he won the tournament for the first time in quite a while in Turkey.
Way to go, John. That's sports on VOA Global. Well, what's happening on the music scene? You know, Christmas and New Year holidays are around the corner, and Billboard's Holiday 100 charts returns this week. Leading the singles list is the vocal quintet Pentatonix with Mary, Did You Know? Let's hear that right now.
Ooh.
Pentatonix, and that's topping the charts on the Christmas singles. Rounding out the top five in descending order are Ariana Grande's Santa Tell Me, Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You, Brenda Lee's Rocking Around the Christmas Tree, it's still on the charts, nice to see, as well as Nat King Cole's holiday classic, The Christmas Song. Pentatonix also leads the top holiday albums chart with That's Christmas to Me.
There are some new albums scheduled for release today, as a matter of fact. The Greatest Hits Decade 1 by Carrie Underwood. The Carter V or the Carter 5 by Lil Wayne. I wish I knew which. 2014 Forest Hills Drive by J. Cole. 36 Seasons by Ghostface Killa. The Dreamwalker by Angels and Airwaves, and Monuments to an Elegy by Smashing Pumpkins. Now, Taylor Swift has returned to number one on this week's Billboard 200 chart with 1989. That chart recently underwent a change in its methodology. Rankings of albums were previously based only on sales. Now included are on-demand streaming and digital track sales. Top 10 reviews on this week from the Billboard 200 chart.
Tomorrow is Friday, thankfully, and on VOA Global, Ray McDonald will count down the top five singles of the week. This is VOA Global.
Yes, it is. And you might know, as everybody knows who McDonald's is. Everybody has McDonald's. I mean, the McDonald's are everywhere, are
they
not?
Right. Well, they seem to be anyway.
Well, they're not doing very well over much of the world. And McDonald's now is planning to change its menu. Trim it down, it says. Review its cooking methods and maybe even get rid of some of the ingredients it uses to change perceptions that it serves junk food. How they're going to do that? CEO Don Thompson sought to reassure investors Wednesday that such changes will help strengthen the chain's appeal as it fights to hold on to customers. A discussion, which took place at the company's headquarters outside Chicago in Oak Brook, Illinois, came after the company earlier this week reported yet another monthly decline in U.S. sales in November. It said the figure fell 4.6% at established locations.
Well, as you may know, Apple and IBM are probably the most unlikely of allies, but they have announced the first fruits of a partnership that's aimed at developing new mobile software and selling more mobile devices to business customers.
Pray tell.
They have a new app developed jointly by the two companies. It promises to help telecom service workers find their way to customer appointments in the field more quickly. They're using GPS on an iPhone or an iPad. Another would let flight attendants help passengers change their connecting reservations while they're in midair.
Well, that is going to wrap up our program for this day. We thank you so much for being with us. As always, our thank you goes to Tracy Carter as our director. Diane Gal is our managing editor. And we thank you so much for being with us. Jim and I will be back with you tomorrow. And hopefully at the same time, the same place, or wherever you
same bat channel
find to listen to us. Have a good day, everybody.
Bye.